This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Not long ago, there was an organization called the Metropolitan Oasis Community Development Corporation. It left the scene for a while, but it's back. And tell us more about it. We have the daughter of the founder of the organization, Toya Robinson, with us. And Toya, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me, good morning.
Thank you, and the same to you. And give a few minutes to tell us all a little bit about the organization and about the organization that your late father, Pastor Floyd Dumas Sr., had put out.
I'd be happy to. Thank you again for having me on to talk about our agency. Metropolitan Oasis was founded out of the auspices of the Metropolitan Baptist Church that my dad pastored for over 38 years. And he had a vision of an oasis in a desert that could meet the total man's needs for the community. And so that's how the oasis, the name was born. Mm-hmm. And so he also wanted to meet the whole man with secular counseling in addition to the spiritual counseling he already offered through the church. And so Metropolitan Oasis then became a beacon of light on 16th and Broadway, offering a variety of counseling and substance abuse treatment to our community, and have been doing so since 1992.
I understand that, as you mentioned earlier here, a lot of social as well as spiritual problems were addressed here by your father when the organization was first established. And among the issues I know that they may take up will be problems maybe people have with substance abuse or other types of issues. And I guess that drew the attention, I understand, of the state government, in particular the Department of Child Services. And that is how I understand got you all involved back again in helping people out. Tell us about the program called the Reform Family Preservation Program that the state has and how the Oasis CDC is going to help out here.
Oh, absolutely. So the Reform Program it stands for Rescue and Empower Families to Observe and Restore and Manage. Mm-hmm. And through this particular program, it's a family preservation program. We do a menu of services with the family. And what the state wanted to do is to not re-injure the family by having, by having multiple providers in their homes, but to have one provider to deliver services for substance abuse, to deliver services for parenting. Services for the safety of the children to ensure that they are getting everything that they need when it comes to schooling, when it comes to being vaccinated. And so through the reform program, the Oasis is actually doing a very good job of delivering those services to our families in the communities that are identified by the Department of Child Services.
This is probably a better setup, certainly during the coronavirus pandemic that we're still facing here in Northwest Indiana and everywhere, to have this few people in, but the most people helping out.
Absolutely. And it allows for us to, or my staff, to work remotely in terms of administrative tasks. But we do go into the homes of the families, and we do have a protocol for the COVID-19 safety of the families and the children. We wear masks, we hand out our sanitizer, and we follow those precautions that are outlined by the CDC. So it has worked out. We've just been, taking an abundance of caution.
Now, I understand that a lot of the procedures that the CDC works with are what are called evidence-based models. Would you explain that term and how it fits into what the Oasis CDC is doing?
Absolutely. So the Department of Child Services did a lot of research on different treatment modalities, and they used the California Clearinghouse to identify those treatment modalities that produce the best outcomes. And so through the reform program, i.e. the family preservation program that has been outlined by the state, we use five evidence-based treatment methods to help our families reach their goals. And so one of them is parents as teachers. The second is trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, which is geared towards substance abuse, multi-systemic therapy, systemic training for effective parenting, which is our premier parenting curriculum, and then adult-focused family behavior therapy. Those are the six modalities that we use that are evidence-based therapy treatments.
Now, Toya, as you and the organization are heading into 2021, what are the plans to look ahead to continue on the program, in particular the one that the state child services organization has gotten you involved in, but anything else?
Well, we are planning for an expansion. There are a lot of community members that are suffering through this pandemic in terms of just food insecurity, clothing insecurity, just trying to meet the basic needs of their households. And so we're looking to relaunch because we did have a food pantry, a clothing pantry, which was very prevalent at our agency. So we're looking to relaunch and to partner with our church, New Shallow Baptist Church, to continue that and to expand on that.
Toya Robinson is the creator, along with her father, the late Pastor Floyd Dumas Sr., at least in recent years, but continuing on his work as the new CEO and head of Metropolitan Oasis CDC. And Toya, thank you for joining us to tell us about the organization, about the opportunities that the state government has given you to get back into the helping of people here in Northwest Indiana and in the city of Gary in particular, and looking ahead to the new programs in the future. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Chris, and have a very happy new year to you.
Medical professionals across the country are being vaccinated against COVID-19. For Dr. Gabriel Bosselet, who is a pulmonologist in Indianapolis, it was a day that he'll never forget. He spoke with Side Effect Public Media's Carter Barrett before getting the vaccine and again just hours after getting the first dose. Here's the conversation.
Sure. I'm Gabriel Bosselet. I am Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine in pulmonary and critical care medicine at the IU School of Medicine. I got the email Saturday late evening to schedule my vaccination, and I got on immediately. To me, it's the only sort of hope we've had this whole time, and it's sort of the best hope possible. It's crazy. I'm emotional about it. I get teary-eyed when I'm doing it right now. I get teary-eyed when I think about it. You know, I knew I was carrying around a lot of baggage about this pandemic, and I knew it's been really stressful. But until all this happened, I had no idea the amount of stress that I was carrying. And I can't express to you how excited I am to get that needle in my arm. It is a tangible thing that I'll be able to feel that will be a little painful, but that will signal the beginning of the end of this hell. Look, I wouldn't roll up my sleeve for something that I didn't trust. You know, I'm not going to put something in my body that I don't think is going to definitively be of benefit both to me and to humanity. If those of us who have been on the front lines are not only willing, but good gravy, most of us are absolutely giddy that this is happening. Like, I've never seen people more. You know, physicians are usually a relatively sedate bunch, and we're like school children with this thing. This vaccine, from a scientific perspective, first of all, is the equivalent of putting a man on the moon. We shouldn't minimize that. What the scientists had been able to do in the last 9 months is absolutely miraculous. But getting the vaccine and sort of being someone who's willing to take the vaccine is our opportunity to sacrifice, an extremely minimal sacrifice, both for our country and for humanity as a whole. And I think my personal opinion is to look at it any other way, you know, to look at it as just getting a shot or however you want to look at it, is to minimize what this means for Americans and for the world. Because I don't want to wear a mask anymore, and I want to see my mom and dad. And this minor sacrifice is what's going to get us to the point where we can now see each other without all of these precautions that we've been taking. We don't have to put ourselves in a lot of harm's way to do it. All we have to do is roll up our sleeve and allow a vaccination. And that is a minor sacrifice to go back to the freedoms that we had before.
Hey, Carter, it's Gabe. I got my shot. I had a 5:20 appointment. I got there a little early. There was no line. Start to finish, it was probably a 5-minute affair, and just logistically was perfect. IU Health did an unbelievable job of coordinating something that complex in a very short amount of time. It was emotional. I've not seen a group of healthcare workers with that many smiles, even under masks, for a long time. It just felt hopeful. It felt like things were almost normal again. And it was awesome. I'm super excited. I go back on January 4th for my second inoculation. I can't wait for everyone to get this vaccine and be done with this. I'm just beside myself with glee. So that's it. It was just a great process. And a day I'll never forget, December 16th, 2020.
That's pulmonologist Dr. Gabriel Bosselet of Indianapolis speaking with reporter Carter Barrett. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Local and regional public leaders joined officials from Bridge Partners LLC and other dignitaries on Wednesday to officially cut the ribbon to open the new Klein Avenue Bridge in East Chicago. The structure, planned and built over the past 5 years, was in turn described by the company as the gateway of Lake County. It takes the place of a defective Klein Avenue Bridge over the Indiana Harbor and Ship Canal that was demolished in 2009. Here is Klein Avenue LLC General Manager of Operations Terry Velligan, who was the MC for the event.
This is actually a big day for us, as you can see. We appreciate everybody showing up. This is not only an East Chicago project, Mayor. As you know, he worked tirelessly to get this built. United Bridge Partners, who I work for, worked tirelessly to get this built. All the unions, all the elected officials, Dave Ryan, Senator Lonnie Randolph, thank you very much. So with that, people who had bought tickets for this first drive, we appreciate that. It's going to benefit the Boys and Girls Club of East Chicago and Lake Area United Way. The speaker is a man of determination, great leadership, our CEO from United Bridge Partners, Doug Witt.
Thank you, Terry, and welcome. And I just want to start by saying this is a very, very exciting day for everyone. And to put it into context, this is one of a handful of new bridge structures in the United States in 2020. Which is a unique feat in and of itself. It's over $100 million invested in the community. It was 42 months, which is about half the normal cycle time, or time to open a bridge. Hundreds of jobs and growth for the entire community. I want to thank Mayor Copeland for his leadership and collaboration throughout. I want to thank the A-Team for helping United Bridge Partners get this done, starting with Granite, Trans Systems, and Majeski and Masters, for which we would not have opened this bridge this year without their help. And I want to thank the residents and community of East Chicago and Northwest Indiana for all of your support. Now, I could go on, but Santa pulled me aside earlier and he said, keep it short, keep it crisp. I got a lot of work to do. You may be going home, but I'm just getting started. So thank you all and have a great holiday. Thank you, Doug. Our next speaker is someone, again, with great tenacity. He was at the start of this project with a lot of other people. You see him all around the community. He's constantly looking out for the concern of businesses in Lake County, East Chicago, Hammond, and Whiting. Dave Ryan, President and Executive Director of Lake
Shore Chamber of Commerce. Dave?
Thank you, Terry. This is a great day for Northwest Indiana, particularly East Chicago. And hats off to the workers who have made this happen. Doug Witt, Terry Belligan, Laura Weber, and all the great work men and women who have built this bridge. This thing started 11 years ago, and it wasn't going to happen. On this very spot, NDOT and the governor said, the bridge is down, but we're going to rebuild it. We've got lots of money. In April of that same year, they said, the bridge is permanently closed. We're not going to rebuild it. And sayonara. And so there were a lot of us that got together, a consortium of businesses, right here, stakeholders in this area, met for months and months and months, trying to get something to happen, and couldn't get any traction. Finally, the governor said, you've got till September and to get financing, or we're going to take the entire bridge down. A couple things happened in my life. My brother was killed in an accident, and about a week later, I get a call in my office at the Lakeshore Chamber, and this lady with a southern accent says, I'd like to talk to you about Klein Avenue Bridge. And I said, lady, last thing on my mind right now is the Klein Avenue Bridge, after all the meetings, the hundreds of meetings we've had. She said, what if I build it for free? I said, now you're talking. And what happened after that was another couple of years of wrangling and so forth. But it finally got, Lonnie Randolph is here, Senator Lonnie Randolph, Chet Dobus, Earl Harris Sr. was here. We met Linda Figg at the Gary Airport, and she said, I need to meet with all the area legislators, which we did a couple weeks later. And the governor said, I'll give you 15 minutes, and that's all. It's all the time I've got for you. An hour and a half she spent with the governor after she got inside the door, and this thing was off and running. So to make a long story short, after 11 years, the bridge is dedicated. Hats off to all the hard workers. Terry, your crew has done a tremendous job, and Doug, and for the financing and so forth, and Laura Weber for putting this together. But hats off, really, to all of you construction people that have put this together. I want to give you a big hand for making it happen. First time you go through, the toll's free. After that, I can't help you.
Thank you, Dave. Our next speaker, again, much like Dave was at the start, and he could probably go through the whole history with you, not only of the bridge itself, of getting this bridge built, but half of East Chicago as well. So I'd like to welcome to the stand Senator Lonnie Randolph.
This is a very great, fantastic occasion. Like David indicated, this has been a long trip in terms of trying to get this bridge rebuilt. And I'm very happy and very pleased to have that. When we talk about jobs, we talk about interstate commerce, we're talking about development, we talk about hope, we're talking about prosperity. So I'm labeling this bridge the bridge of prosperity, not just for East Chicago, but for the whole region. Because when you talk about businesses, corporations, you're talking about saving money, and save money by transportation. The quicker you get there, the cheaper it is, the more you can sell your product for in terms of maximize the profitability for the company. The more profit you make, the more people you can hire, the more construction you can build, the more expansion you can develop. But I'm very happy to see the culmination of the efforts of a lot of people concerning putting this and making this happen. So I take my hat off to everybody. City of Chicago, the administrators, particularly the legislators who were so involved with putting this together, the Northwest Indiana legislators, and as the contractors, hey, you guys did a yeoman's job, and you deserve applause, and I applaud you all. Thank you very much for having me today.
So before I get to our next speaker and our final speaker, I just want to say, as kind of piggyback off of Senator Lonnie Randolph, this is actually a whole conglomerate of everybody helping out. And as you look around the people that are standing here, we have Mayor Jerome Prince from Gary, thank you. Congressman-elect Mr. Mervan, thank you. Representative from Mike Braun's office, Tony Ferraro, thank you. We have the Sheriff, Oscar Martinez, thank you. We have the unions, iron workers, carpenters, laborers, operators, electricians. We have people from Whiting. Thank you. This is our project in Chicago, but it's our project in Lake County. You can see all the benefits that this brings and all the people that help make this happen. So I just want to say thank you to all those people. The next speaker, you know him. I am proud to be a resident of East Chicago. I am proud to see Mayor Copeland with the perseverance, the leadership, and the understanding of us as quote-unquote region rats to pull together despite all the obstacles, despite the 11 years, despite the pandemic, despite the ups and downs of economy, to lead us to this point. And I'm very proud to be knowing Mayor Copeland and be a part of this project. So, Mayor, please.
Thank you very much, Jerry. As I look down, I see a long line of cars going all the way down. Look like they're making it all the way down through Whiting on to Hammond. And they say there's no I in team. And today is a testament of that. This has been 11 years in the making. I can remember when we first started. Other legislators, they wanted to argue and squabble about where the money was coming from. But I remember the state told us in three languages they wasn't going to give us the money. We put together a private relationship with the Fig Bridge Group, and we was able to get this done. So today, I'm going to be able to say, start your engines, and then all of a sudden, let the residual 10-cent come in. So again, each and every one of you, love you. Thank you for enduring this endeavor. So again, history will mark this day as a great occasion. Thank you.
That was East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland. After his remarks, the ribbon was cut, followed by a long line of vehicles that were parked at the point where the transponders are placed at one end of the 1.7-mile-long toll bridge. It'll be open free of charge until January 31st. Tolls will be $1 to EasyPass and iPass users during the month of February, and then they'll return to the regular toll prices in March. As the coronavirus in Indiana's grip is tightened and the country, end-of-year holidays are causing concern about the exponential rise in cases. And with vaccine availability for the general public likely still months away, more lives will be lost. But is a full shutdown the answer? Reporter Brock Turner has more on the tough choices that face the policymakers.
Like many Hoosiers, Tanya Mintgen is ready to put 2020 behind her. She owns three fat labs, an event venue, and bed and breakfast in Putnam County. 2020 has challenged her business in nearly every way.
I ended up canceling March, April, May, and most of June. I got my last June wedding off here. So, you know, that's pretty much 4 months of revenue. It's the staff didn't make any money.
Appearing in the Netflix series Say I Do led to a significant increase in bookings for 2021. But Mintgen worries if virus cases are still high next year, people will continue to cancel their plans, weddings, and other special events.
With the ones that were postponed and moved, and the few that decided to cancel, I probably took a $175,000 hit.
The governor's latest order restricts crowd sizes to 25 in the highest-risk counties, which is nearly half the state. Larger events can still receive special permits from local health departments, but that process can be time-intensive. Experts say a robust contact tracing program would allow for the greatest economic freedom while limiting the virus's spread. Even if businesses are closed, targeted aid could assist them. Much of that aid, though, hasn't come from the federal government yet. Congress is still debating a second economic stimulus, which has handcuffed many state and local officials. Most agree the lack of federal support paired with poor contact tracing has led to the difficult choice Holcomb and local governments face. Eileen White experienced this firsthand.
We didn't have a public health push in the governor's ear that was as impactful as the business community. And so it became a choice that doesn't really exist, because you can't really have a strong economy without, during a pandemic, if people don't trust, people won't go spend money. So, you know, we've all gotten into this battle about whether the economy should open or we should take care of the virus, but it's really, it all has to work together.
A As an epidemiologist, she's worked in several states and was eager to help her local health department in Fishers, but resigned after just a few weeks on the job, alleging political bias impacted science and data. That's something Fishers Mayor Scott Fadness denied, but he does agree that local governments can be put in a precarious spot.
They're granted the authority to take away people's abilities to do things and to restrict them in terms of commerce. But as a government, we are not provided the resources to alleviate some of those restrictions. So in a perfect world, you would have both capabilities so that you could architect a solution that says, hey, we have to change these behaviors for a period of time, and we know that that has an economic consequence. And we can tailor a solution in our local economy to try to ease the burden on those most impacted.
White says choosing between fewer infections and an open economy is a false choice, but believes a number of factors contribute to this narrative.
I see that this is a struggle, right? Nobody in public health is saying that the economy isn't important. But what we're saying is that lots and lots of people getting sick will impact the economy.
Micah Pollack, an economist at Indiana University, agrees.
And when you talk about like the stay-at-home order or shutting down the economy, that's an extreme, right? That's we're going to shut everything down. Or even just opening everything up is another extreme. Kind of the optimal should be something where we identify the things that are spreading the virus the most and are also the easiest for us to reduce.
For many, it's too late. The pandemic's impact has been more acutely felt in certain populations. Gary Lemon, a professor of economics at DePaul University, says employees like Mentgen's have been among the hardest hit and deserve targeted aid.
The burden has not been distributed equally across all sectors. And so people who cannot work remotely have been hit harder.
All Mentgen and her employees can hope for now is this virus and the restrictions it has been married with in 2020 will be mitigated when weddings begin this spring. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Back with you tomorrow.